Good morning. We're going to call the Agriculture and Food Finance and Policy Division to order. We don't yet have a quorum, but we will get started with our presentations, and we have something in the middle of the, in front of the testimony table that needs to be moved. Thank you. We do have a full agenda today. Last week, we also had a full agenda each day, and I just will let you know that our intention is never to go long. Unfortunately, last Thursday, we had a lot of people presenting a lot of information, and so we had to run over a little bit. So that's not our intention. If we find that we're going to be doing that, we may have to have an evening scheduled to kind of balance that out. But our intention is to try to fit people and all of the testimony and all of the presentation into the time that we have. And we just encourage people to work with us as much as possible to be able to do that. But we also want to today talk about, we have division pages that actually have been assigned to us now. So Benjamin Kretzinger and Seaver Holter are the two pages. So welcome to the committee. And then also today is Minnesota Farmers Union Lobby Day. So we will be potentially seeing people from the Minnesota Farmers Union coming in and out. I know that they have a special guest. Governor Walz is going to be meeting with them, I think, at 10. So they are perhaps not here this morning, but you may be meeting with people individually for that. I also want to just note that we are going to be talking about food a bit today and on Thursday, but we talk about food maybe more often, but it's as a part of agriculture. And I did note that the Minnesota Farm Bureau is talking about food access in February and March. So, you know, it's on people's minds, and so that's what we want to be able to highlight today a little bit. We do have minutes in the packet, and so Representative Brand.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move the minutes from the last meeting.
Okay, so the minutes are before us from the from our most recent meeting, and anybody have any comments or questions about that? Actually, do we have a quorum yet? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Nope, we're still short, so we're not going to do the minutes. Okay, we'll pass those. Now we do, I think. we'll hold on the minutes till later, just till we get settled in. That's fine. So again, we're just. Welcome, everyone. We will talk about food and food access and food security and how we talk about healthy food and making sure that people are able to get the necessary nutrients that they need. And today we will hear the Good Food Access Bill. That is one that will be held over for possible inclusion in a finance bill. But we are hoping to move along with our presentations this morning. So the beginning of the presentation here, we have approximately 45 minutes that we've allotted, but we're going to work with that. First, to talk about Ela Roche is here. She's a project director from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and talk about the Healthy Food Access Study. So welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself and present your information. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Before we get started, I must insert our disclaimer that the views expressed in my testimony this morning are my own and are not necessarily representative of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis or the Federal Reserve System. Thank you for this opportunity to address the issue of healthy food access in Minnesota, and to share with you some numbers that illustrate both the reach and the magnitude of the problem that we face. In Minnesota, the share of residents with low retail access to healthy food ranks among the top 10 highest in the country, and we have more people living in rural communities who face this barrier than any other state except Texas. Such disparities interest us at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis because we recognize the strong correlation between health and economic well-being for individuals and communities. The issue of healthy food access has implications for small business development, for infrastructure development, and for human capital development. All of these factors influence the robustness of our state's economy. In 2016, the Minneapolis Fed and Wilder Research conducted an independent study on healthy food access in Minnesota. A copy of the report and summary slides are included in your briefing packet, and if you need additional copies, I can get them to you. The goals of this study were, one, to shed light on the barriers related to healthy food access, consumption, and retail expansion for Minnesota. Two, to provide an objective picture of the relationship between healthy food retail access and diet-related health outcomes. Three, to offer insight on the outcomes of existing healthy food financing initiatives in the United States and on important factors for successful operation. And four, to offer a common foundation of information for groups to act upon. The study report includes information on which areas and populations in Minnesota have low access to healthy food. These data will be the focus of my remarks today. While our report was published in 2016, the data which come from the USDA Economic Research Service are the most current data available. Because the factors that influence food access are slow to change, we can be confident that these numbers are still accurate. Now, when we talk about the issue of low access to healthy food, it is important to understand some key terms. Allow me to walk through these definitions with you. The first term is food insecure. People who are food insecure have an income barrier to healthy food access. They cannot afford to purchase healthy food because of low or no income. The second term is low retail access. People with low retail access have a distance barrier to healthy food access. By federal definition, these individuals are considered to have low retail access if they live far away from a large grocery store, a supermarket, or a supercenter. That's more than 1 mile in urban areas and more than 10 miles in rural areas. The third term, which is relevant for federal funding purposes, is food desert area. This definition takes into consideration both income and distance. In order to qualify as a federally designated food desert, a census tract must have a high proportion of residents who live far from a full-service grocery store and have a high proportion of residents who are low to moderate income. This metric is very specific. An exact definition can be found in the appendix of our Healthy Food Access Study report. With those definitions in mind, here are some key statistics on healthy food access in Minnesota that capture the magnitude of this problem that affects thousands of residents who live in your districts. About 1.6 million Minnesotans have low retail access based on their distance to a full-service store. An estimated 500,000 Minnesotans are food insecure based on low or no income. An estimated 341,000 Minnesotans face both distance and income barriers to healthy food access. An estimated 42,500 households live more than 1 mile away from a full-service store and do not own a vehicle. And about 16% of Minnesota's census tracts qualify as federally designated food deserts. In summary, about 31% of Minnesotans have low retail access to healthy food. This is higher than the rate for the United States overall, which sits at 24%. And as I mentioned previously, we rank among the top 10 worst in the nation. Who are the residents with low retail healthy food access in Minnesota? What do we know about their age, their income, and their race? In urban communities and population centers, an estimated 1.4 million people are impacted. About 1 in 5 are low income, 1 in 10 are seniors, and 1 in 4 are children. In rural communities, an estimated 233,000 people are impacted. And among this group, 1 in 3 are low income, 1 in 5 are seniors, and 1 in 4 are children. In greater Minnesota, we have 24 counties where 100% of their census tracts qualify as federally designated food deserts. Among them are Cook, Coochiching, Red Lake, and Redwood. And in 20 greater Minnesota counties, at least 50% of the county census tracts are federally designated food deserts. And among them are Cottonwood, Renville, Swift, Todd, and Wadena. The majority of Minnesotans who face barriers to healthy food access are white, but indigenous people and populations of color are disproportionately affected. When we examine reservation areas, we see that all of Red Lake Reservation area falls into a food desert, and that large proportions of White Earth, Leech Lake, Mille Lacs, and Boyce Fort Reservation areas do also. In Monoman County, 59% of residents living in food deserts are people of color, and in Beltrami County, 38% of residents living in food desert areas are people of color. In both of these counties, most of these individuals are Native American or of mixed race. If we examine the location of food deserts in the Twin Cities metro area, we see that these census tracts overlap areas with large populations of color as well. This includes neighborhoods in North Minneapolis and Brooklyn Center, in Dayton's Bluff and on the greater east side of St. Paul, and in Maplewood. The proportion of residents who are people of color in these communities ranges from 31 to 83%. Now, to be clear, distance to retail is just one factor that influences healthy food purchasing decisions. Price, income, education, and retail store type have independent and important effects on behavior, too. Based on what we know from academic research, there are additional factors that I would encourage the committee members to keep in mind as you craft legislation related to healthy food access. Price is the most significant barrier to healthy food consumption for low to moderate income households. Poor health outcomes are more strongly linked to poverty than distance to healthy food retail. Store type can affect food purchases, and supercenters are associated with less healthy purchases. And differences in transportation mode have little effect on the types of stores used. Among supplemental nutrition assistance program users, also known as SNAP, 90% use a full-service outlet as their primary store, and 68% drive their own car. Transportation is certainly a greater barrier for households that do not own a vehicle. Healthy food financing initiatives, such as the Good Food Access Fund in Minnesota, play an important role in addressing low retail access. We know from our research that flexible sources of capital are key when it comes to leveraging the potential impact of these funds. In that regard, both loans and grants are needed. On average, businesses that receive loans have a high repayment rate and a low failure rate. We also know that access to technical assistance and outreach are important for the long-term success of these food businesses. Finally, we know that healthy food financing initiatives have little impact on healthy food consumption alone, but that loan fund recipients who partner with schools, with community clinics, and with fitness facilities can play a key role in expanding consumer choice and in shaping healthy behaviors. Our study report contains additional information about healthy food financing initiatives and the food retail landscape in Minnesota for those who are interested in learning more. In closing, I just want to emphasize that healthy food access is not just a population health issue. It affects small business development, it affects educational outcomes, and it's imperative to the economic well-being of our state. Again, I thank you for this opportunity to share our research, and I'm happy to take your questions at this time.
All right. Well, thank you for the presentation, Dr. Roche. And we will bring down our next presenters, and we may bring you back up as they conclude in case any other questions come up. So thank you for the presentation.
Thank you.
Bayang Mao? Maoa?
Moa.
I apologize, excuse moi
and say it literally.
Thank you very much. I apologize for mispronouncing your name, but welcome to the committee. And we are going to ask you to state your name and then begin your presentation. Thank you.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vajong Moa. It's not spelled phonetically, so it'll probably throw you off. And if it's any consolation, it's an uncommon name within the Hmong community itself. So you're off the hook a little bit there. I want to first begin by applauding the name of this committee. is, to my knowledge, is the first time that the legislature has created an agriculture and food committee. I think that is a long overdue recognition of our state and of our communities, and sees for us to see an explicit connection between the food system, our nutrition, our community health, and our agriculture system. And so I just want to begin with that recognition first. My purpose here today is twofold, the personal and the professional is deeply interwoven for me. I was born in Laos, born to parents who were nomadic farmers, and I came to this country as a refugee. But my people for millennia were farmers who took up farming not only as a business, but more so as livelihood and for sustenance. And so the connection between food, culture, and livelihood is a deep thread throughout my personal and professional thread. And I would argue that is a thread that is central to the conversation today. Professionally, I am the Health Equity Director at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. This is an organization that took on the tobacco industry. My department is rooted in a courageous challenge with the tobacco industry, and it's my view, and I'll offer a brief disclaimer here too. This is not a Blue Cross perspective, but it's my view that this is blood money taken from the tobacco industry, and so we can channel those resources back to prevent the leading causes of death and disease, which still, number one, is commercial tobacco use. Close on its heels is unhealthy eating and physical inactivity. But we know that we can't just hand out pedometers or healthy cookbooks or tell people to stop smoking, and that education is necessary but insufficient in itself, and that the magnitude of these issues that we're taking on warrant us going upstream to work outside of traditional and conventional health care. I'm going to try to avoid, since I come from an oral tradition, I'm going to try to avoid reading my notes as much as possible. There may be a few times when I have to cite a few hard data points, but I'm going to try to avoid that. My goal today is to really offer a broad but precise primer on the connection between food security, health care, and health equity. Okay. I'm thankful for Ela for offering the hard data, the science behind this, and so I'm going to try to fill in the health connections, and I'm fortunate to be sandwiched between two researchers and academics who can help complement our story today. I'm not sure if this community has ever heard anyone from the healthcare industry or a health insurance company speak here. I would argue that your committee has as much, if not more, influence on improving the health outcomes of Minnesotans than Health and Human Services. And that's not a minimization of healthcare or the other committees, but what we know from public health science, the main drivers, the main creators of health or the absence of health lies outside of healthcare. Only 10% of what creates health is within the four walls of a physician's office. Another 10% is genetic. And what science is revealing today, that even that 10%, because of epigenetics, isn't fixed. Right? Your genetic makeup is always in flux with your physical and social environment. 30% comes from behaviors like smoking, sedentary lifestyles, and unhealthy eating. And when I say those behaviors, I want to make sure that they're not just individual behaviors. Those are community-wide behaviors. 40% is what we term the social determinants of health. That's income, education, geography, race, ethnicity. These are factors that are both circumstance and based on your situation. Okay. So you could be born into this, and it could be the environment in which you live in. So you'll notice that the majority of what shapes health or takes away health actually lies outside of health care. Okay, so I just want to be very clear that the connection to, between food security and health care and health equity is not some like 20 standard deviations away. It is in the name of prevention and community health that Blue Cross Blue Shield and the health care industry needs to get involved with these types of policy and political conversations. Okay, so I just want to be very clear about that. You've probably heard of the term health equity or health disparities. I just want to do a quick distinction there. Disparity is simply a numerical difference. Okay, you could say, and this is an actual example, the average smoking rate of Minnesotans is about 14%. The smoking rate in the American Indian community is 59%. Okay, that's just there's a numerical difference in prevalence there. Okay, health inequity, according to the World Health Organization and our own Department of Health, is a difference in health that is avoidable, preventable, and unjust. Okay, so they're laying a causation to that difference, not just it's just different by chance or different by accident. And again, what the social determinants of health tells us is that most of what creates health or the absence is outside of healthcare, that it is driven by human decision making, by policymakers, by people who oversee budgets, staffing plans. Okay, so the inequities that you see in health, whether you're looking at cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, the achievement gap, the inequities in housing, employment, these are not inevitable. And so I want to be very clear that those differences are by human design, okay? Which is often not easy to detect when we talk about social determinants of health, which can sometimes connote just an inevitable state of nature, right? And that's not what we're up against. What we know from the science is we have the ability to change that course. So I want to, at the risk of overkilling that point, that distinction between disparity and equity. I also want to take a moment to ensure that health and racial equity is understood as a common good, as a nonpartisan term. These are terms that are used by the Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. These are not tilted to any political party. This is rooted in science and community wisdom. And so I just want to be extra clear about that. Okay. I want to next, Lorna, if I'm running over or under time, please hold me accountable. Again, I run a long time and we're usually never on time. Okay. So, I want to then shift to the health equity case. So I think we all know that chronic disease, diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, that everyone, this affects every community. But I also want to counter the notion that these are equal opportunity killers. They're not. The prevalence and the morbidity and the mortality rates differ greatly across different cultural and ethnic groups, different income groups, okay? Before you have a study called The Economic Costs of Health Inequities. And I just want to pull out a few things. Please peruse that at your leisure. But first of all, the inequities in health. We know that American Indians have four times the rate of chronic disease compared to the general population. The Asian Pacific community has three times that rate. The African-American, 1.5, Latino, 1.2, okay? And I want to make sure that we do not abandon the case for saving lives, but I want to complement that by saying there's a serious economic and healthcare cost to this. We commissioned a study with the University of Minnesota, and what we found is the cost of these inequities is $2.26 billion per year. $2.26 billion per year based on these inequities. And that's based on the healthcare costs, the cost in lost employment and the cost in lost productivity, $2.26 billion just per year. That's the equivalent of the construction of 54 hospitals. That's the cost of 15 high schools. That's the cost of the annual coverage for 47,000 assisted living facilities. And that's the cost of covering costs for 25,000 people in nursing home facilities. So just to give you a sense of scale and magnitude and the opportunity costs of these inequities. So certainly there's a moral imperative here, but it's just good economic sense as well. Okay. So I'm going to move on from the health equity primer there, and please peruse that study at your leisure. I just saw the friendly wave from Lorna to wrap up, so I'm going to take the express route here. I want to make sure that you understand there's a clear connection between diabetes and food insecurity. What the research tells us is the cost of food insecurity is $77 billion per year. This is on a national basis. And I'm happy to send you the extensive research or the abstract or there's a plethora of evidence around this connection. Okay. So you really hear kind of the health impact, but the healthcare, and that was just for the healthcare cost alone, $77 billion. Okay. And then we also know that those folks who are food insecure, they have more difficulty managing their care, managing diabetes, that they're already dealing with so many distractions and challenges that once you have food insecurity, it only magnifies the other challenges that you face. So I just want to be clear again that this is a cross-cutting issue, and there's a direct link between food security, chronic disease, healthcare costs, and candidly, our workforce and our broader economy. Okay. So I urge you to continue to push for increasing food access across the state, across different cultural communities, across different geographies. It's not only the right thing to do, it's a smart thing to do. We want to make sure that health is not a privilege or a strategic choice, that it's just convenient, that it's just in our atmosphere, that's everywhere we go, that making the healthy choice is truly the easiest choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Mm-hmm. And then we've got Dr. Durgan and Kathy Drager are going to come down. They're going to talk about the grocery store survey. All of these things are in your packet, members. We don't have anything up on the screen, but you have information in your packet. So welcome to the committee. If you want to introduce yourselves, please, and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Chair Poppy, rest of the committee. My name is Bev Durgan. I'm Dean of University of Minnesota Extension, and it's a pleasure for us to be here today to talk about food access and food insecurity in Minnesota. And I think you've heard from the previous testimony today that too many Minnesotans, especially our rural residents of Minnesotans, including the farmers who grow our food, do not have consistent access to healthy foods. University of Minnesota has a presence in all 87 counties of the state, and we work on food issues in many ways. One, with our SNAP recipients in the state, with an educational program, nutrition program, growing food, distributing food, working with food shelves, and also gardens. So we are there throughout the state helping with the production of food, the distribution of food, and making sure that people have access to healthy foods. But we know, as we've heard today, is that's not the case through all of Minnesota. So one of the things that University of Minnesota Extension is doing is to meet this challenge is to work with rural grocery stores. And many of you know that rural grocery stores really are the backbone of food access to many of our rural residents. And I think you also know that many of our rural grocery stores are struggling. We hear every day about rural grocery stores that are closing or rural grocery stores that want to transition to new owners and have struggles doing that. And so today I have with me Dr. Kathy Drager, who is our statewide director of Extension's Regional Sustainable Development Partnership. partnerships. And Dr. Drager is really leading in the nation on the work with rural grocery stores and what we can do to support those grocery stores and make sure that they remain in our rural communities. For those of you that are not familiar with the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, they were established by the legislature in 1997, and they really were an experiment or a new way of looking with communities. So we have five regional boards throughout the state, and their boards are unique in that two-thirds of the board members are community members, and the rest are University of Minnesota staff and faculty. And this is a way for us to look at issues through the state and really connect all of the University of Minnesota, not just the colleges that we work with the extension to work on those issues. So with that, I will turn the mic over to Kathy, and she can talk a little bit about some of the work we're doing with rural grocery stores and some of the issues that those rural grocery stores are facing.
Welcome, Dr. Drager.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I very much appreciate your time today. I'm very passionate about rural grocery stores. It's not just a professional interest, but my I live in Big Stone County, Minnesota, with my family of five, where we farm, and so that is a designated rural food desert, and we still have three grocery stores remaining. I'm counting them. When I moved there 11 years ago, we had five grocery stores. So I've been able to witness the loss of grocery stores just from the very area that I live. And as I said, a designated USDA rural food desert. And so I'm very happy to be here today with my colleagues to talk about this important issue of food access. We have a very important asset. We have real hard physical infrastructure across the entire Minnesota landscape that is rural grocery stores. So these stores, and we have somewhere around 250 of these stores remaining in the state, these stores are the front line in rural residents having access to the full array of healthy food, including fresh fruits and vegetables and meat and dairy and all the full range of a grocery cart. However, many of these small town stores are facing issues of closure, and we're struggling to keep a lot of them open. I'll give you some data and some towns in a minute. But for those of you who have lived in rural communities, you know that these stores are a Main Street anchor. They're employers. They're really important community gathering places. And really, in many ways, having a grocery store in your town is central to the well-being and character of your community. These are private enterprises, but they provide a lot of public good throughout the state, and they are under threat today. So I think rural grocery stores are closing at an unprecedented rate. The impact which is being felt through rural communities, not just in Minnesota, but nationwide. And we find that these closures are permanent. And new owners and new stores are not replacing those that are shuttered. We continue to work with communities that are looking for alternative models. The city of Keister has a community-owned grocery store, and we're looking at other different methods of grocery store ownership and maintenance. But we're still struggling to see that once they close, the majority of them stay closed. We just in the last few weeks lost another grocery store in Fairfax, Minnesota. That would be in Representative Miller's district, and they just recently lost, or not recently, but a few years ago, another grocery store in Kirkhoven. And just in the recent news articles, I think you'll recognize Aurora, Onamia, Miltona, Wanamingo, Lester Prairie, Randall, Evansville, just to name a few, have all lost their grocery stores in recent months. Again, as I said, once it closes, it's difficult to open. That's why I feel like we really need to bolster this sector now and preserve these rural food access points throughout greater Minnesota. In December, we got a call from the community of Eota, Minnesota, population 2015. They reached out to University of Minnesota Extension for help with issues keeping their rural grocery store, the Eota Market, open. After the store's owner died several years ago, the family needed help from the community to keep it open. So on one evening in December, more than 100 people from all corners of the community came for a standing room only meeting at the Eota American Legion Hall. Our Northeast Executive Director. His name is Dr. Oke Ukaga, and Ren Olive, who's our lead rural grocery store staff person, went to that meeting to learn what the issues are and to offer any resources and support that we can have. Basically, they're still trying to find someone who's going to be able to step in and keep that grocery store open for the community. And we've been involved in a number of situations like that through the years. Our staff did report that there was a lot of energy in that community and that there was a lot of concern as well about having that grocery store closed. So those are some kind of anecdotes that I gave you about stores that are closing. But we also have a lot of data. So what do we know? The regional partnerships have been gathering information about the issues faced by rural grocery stores for more than a decade, starting with a rural grocer that served on one of our boards with a group of faculty that led us to really engage with this group of grocery stores throughout the state. We also took two busloads of grocery store owners down to the National Rural Grocery Summit, that's a thing, at Kansas State University. And I think we have a grocer in the audience who actually attended those meetings as well. So we are part of a national movement to be able to keep these stores open. When we started compiling the list, a database of grocery stores in the state of Minnesota, we were just under 300 stores. That we identified with our colleague Ryan Pesch, who's with Extension Community Vitality. Since then, we have a lot of strikethroughs on that database, and we have dozens of grocery stores that have closed since we started that list in 2015. We used that information to conduct the first ever rural grocery survey of grocery stores throughout the state of Minnesota. We had a remarkable 69% rate, response rate. So those of you who ever do surveys, you can recognize that 69% is a really high return rate for a 20-page, 60-question paper survey to these grocers. And in the comment section, the grocers wrote things like, thank you for caring about our sector. And this was a really intelligent survey. So grocers were appreciative that people were keying in and concerned about them as a sector. Of those stores that we surveyed, 92% sell fresh produce. So again, when we talk about how we get fresh, healthy food out to Minnesotans across the state, rural grocery stores are part of the front line. But not only are consumers walking in the door of those grocery stores to buy food, we found out that they're selling to the schools, restaurants, daycares, nursing homes, and other community institutions. So these grocery stores also have a ripple effect for those other institutions. And I know that in Clinton, Minnesota, where I do my grocery shopping at Bonnie's Hometown Grocery, that the Big Stone County Food Shelf buys their food from Bonnie's. That serves two purposes, right? Gets food to the lowest income people in our county, but it also helps keep the doors open on another grocery store in our community. So there's lots of those types of win-win situations. For the majority of the rural grocery stores in the state, the nearest discount store or large star store is 20 miles or more away. So you can see what the impact would be of losing these remaining 250 or so grocery stores from our state. But one of the things we did find, and now we're going to be repeating this survey again in 2019 with support from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, what we're finding is that the majority of those store owners said that they were going to transition out of their store within 10 years. So that was 4 years ago. So we still have a kind of a ticking clock on these grocery stores transitioning. And we're struggling with those transitions because finding people to step in when we have aging infrastructure, aging freezers, and a number of other business issues facing these stores. So those transitions are really critical point in these businesses. There's some hopeful items on the horizon, and I think the Good Food Access Program is one of those that can really help us shore up grocery stores and keep those stores open, serving healthy food to Minnesotans. We did learn that the majority of stores, 54%, had increasing consumer demand for locally grown produce. So when we learned that, we went to work and created a farm-to-rural grocery toolkit so that both the grocery store owners and the farmers would have a higher level of comfort with what are the regulations, what's the safe food handling, what do we need to do to have food go from farm-to-rural grocery, which is another strategy that both supports the farm economy as well as gives consumers retail access, you know, in a grocery setting to locally grown food. And when we learned that grocers said that they were experiencing challenges in meeting consumer quality expectations for their produce, we created a produce handling guide that was just a handy-dandy chart with every kind of fruit and vegetable and what temperature and what humidity. Because these small-town grocery store owners are keeping their produce cases open. At the same time, they're scrubbing the floors, manning the till, ordering the groceries, and taking the checks to the bank. So they don't have produce managers like maybe some of our larger stores in the cities do. So we found that to be a very handy thing. And that's one of the advantages of another piece of infrastructure that we have in the state, which is the University of Minnesota and University of Minnesota Extension, because we could actually bring in a faculty member who does post-harvest handling and does fruit and vegetable handling who could help us go through, and so that a grocer knows how they need to store kale or asparagus or strawberries so that it stays the maximum quality in their produce case. And the regional partnerships as part of Extension was able to bring that then. We got those produce handling toolkits to every grocer, every small town grocer in a community under 2,500, and then did on-site trainings throughout the state as well. One other area that our survey showed we could make an impact on grocery stores was by lowering their energy costs. So energy is a major fixed cost for these grocery stores. So over the three-year period, basically since that survey, we've conducted outreach to 95 grocery stores and helped them do upgrades that saved an estimated 2.1 billion BTUs through eight stores taking action. So that has all kinds of, again, ripple effects for lowering their costs, improving their energy efficiency. And then, as you can imagine, one of the largest economic challenges that these grocery stores are facing is that more than 90% of Minnesota rural grocers told us that they're challenged by competition from large chain grocery stores that have high operating costs, and then they obviously that goes along with high operating costs and narrow margins. And I will tell you, that is a gap in our research. We really need to further research pricing structures. In the last week, I've heard from both small-town grocers and an independent grocery wholesaler that they have concerns about pricing structure for their purchase of products, which is higher than the same product being sold to national chain stores. You know, specifically the owner of the Randall grocery store, and I don't know if anyone's ever been to that Randall grocery store. It is a fabulous, beautiful, state-of-the-art grocery facility. And it's shuttered right now and sitting empty in Randall, Minnesota. And he said just before he closed his doors, he was buying his wholesale price for milk, what he was buying wholesale, was over $2 a gallon for a gallon of skim milk. And that at he named some other competitors, big chain stores, that were selling that milk on the shelf for $1.49, when his wholesale price was 25% higher than he could even get it at, you know, at these other large chain stores. So that's a question I think we need to look into. And further, there's a Wadena, Minnesota-based wholesaler, Mason Brothers, which is another real asset to the state. They supply grocery stores to over 400 small towns in Minnesota, the eastern edge of North and South Dakota, and western Wisconsin. And they shared to me this, and this is a quote that they gave to me: Dollar General retail prices on many items is lower than what Mason Brothers can buy direct from the manufacturer at full truck load pricing. So those are some of the issues that these small town grocers are facing, from the wholesale and to those retail pricing. And I that'll be an area of research that we do going forward. So as I alluded to, I think we have a couple areas that are really hopeful. I think that there's a tension that people were gaining some more consumer loyalty for people to focus and shop at those stores. And I would recommend that any of us who live in rural Minnesota and have access to a small town grocery store, I just encourage you to spend your rural grocery dollars at those stores. Work with your grocer. Ask them to carry what you want to eat if they don't see it on the shelves. I think you'll find them to be really willing partners. And I think the whole farm to grocery, rural grocery, is an excellent combination. I mean, there are people in Clinton, Minnesota, who within their memory remember bringing shell eggs to the grocery store on Saturday night. Yeah, that was part of the food system at one point, farmers bringing food to grocery stores. We've taken that idea of farm to rural grocery one step further, and we are researching, with support from the USDA, a new supply chain model called the backhaul model, which is basically having farm fresh food brought from farm to the rural grocery store. And then when the wholesale truck unloads, we're putting the local foods back on the truck, and it gets into the wholesale market, and we're redistributing it through the network of groceries. So instead of these grocery stores being the last end of a global food supply, they're the front door for a local and regional food supply. And we piloted this after we worked through the regulations and the logistics and the food safety and the vendor requirements. We piloted this in the fall, in last September. And we were able to backhaul almost 5,000 bulbs of garlic through the rural grocery store, back to the wholesaler in Wadena, and then from there it was redistributed to more than 25 grocery stores throughout the region. So we have kind of a pilot proof in concept, and our next hope is that we can expand it and expand the crops that we're doing. And the grocery wholesaler even has said to me, we're really interested in farmstead cheese. Can we get farmstead cheese on those trucks? So in addition to produce, I think we'll be able to look at other farmstead products to do this. So I hope I, Madam Chair, could have a chance to talk about that backhaul project at a later time. It's being featured on the U of M Driven to Discover campaign right now. It's an interesting example of creating a new supply chain that might support small and medium-sized farms in our state. The second piece of hope and infrastructure that we have for these rural grocery stores is the Good Food Access Fund program. And with the help of through U of M Extension, we were able to help many grocers to access these funds. We worked directly and did one-on-one assistance from multiple stores across the state, including many of the Somali and Asian markets, that including one that received a grant in 2019 and others that have applications pending currently. As I mentioned, we were able to help a Red Rooster grocery store in Dashiell switch its grocery lighting over to LEDs. The Lake Benton grocery store was able to replace their freezer with a more energy-efficient model. The freezer they replaced was installed in 1972, and I've seen firsthand how people try to get these freezers to last as long as possible, but they cause a number of operations problems for the grocery stores. But we're just grateful that the Good Food Access Fund has helped us to provide real hard infrastructure for these stores around the state. My parting thoughts are, again, just to encourage everyone, when you are traveling, visiting, living in greater Minnesota, please shop at your local rural grocery stores. And while you're there, I'd also encourage you, if you can meet the owner or the managers, just to thank them. I was in Benson, Minnesota at Daryl's Super Value, and Daryl himself helped bring my groceries out to my car. And I shook his hand and I thanked him. I said, thank you for being on the front line of keeping healthy food access in Benson, Minnesota. And he started crying right there in the parking lot. I think a little appreciation of what these grocers are doing can go a long way in helping them have the courage to keep their stores open. And I much prefer questions to monologue. So
thank you, Dr. Baker. And we have the other, so if there are, now we have four presenters, so if you may want to all remain at the table or come to the table, because we are open for questions, and each of the panelists may be asked questions. So, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Drager, if she could stop back. Well, you're still there.
Okay.
I assume you're not talking about a cash-wise store in St. Cloud as being part of this thing. So how would you further define your rural grocery stores, a mom and pop, or what if they have two locations? Or
yeah.
Help me get that definition more clear.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you. That's a very good question. Our database is all the rural grocery stores in the state in communities with population under 2,500. So that was the definition we used. So we looked at those. In your packet, you should have a sheet that is business characteristics and environment. And you can see that 75% of these stores are mom and pop owned stores. And that's really one of the ways that they're able to keep them open, by putting in 90 hours a week work to have the till running and the groceries ordered and the floor swept. But you'll see some of those. And we also looked at, there were 10% corporate franchises in those small towns. I know that there's, for example, Super Value. And then there was cooperatively owned, and we had one, at least one that I know of, community-owned grocery store. Actually, there's more than that. Bird Island. Bird Island just put out shares, and now their grocery store is all owned by the community as well. So we're seeing some models come into play.
Right. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Chair Poppy. Dr. Drager, I was very interested in this information that talks about rural grocers selling fresh produce locally to institutions. As someone who grew up in a small town and is concerned about rural areas, I wasn't quite aware of that local economic link. And I'm currently talking with some local farmers in my district and statewide are very interested in building farm-to-school connections and wanting to get local foods into institutions locally, hospitals, nursing homes, others. I'm just curious about your thoughts on steps that we all can take to be strengthening these connections with local farmers to schools, to grocery stores, and strengthening these local economic links for rural communities.
Dr. Drager, we'll start with you, and if others would like to respond too.
Madam Chair, Representative Lippert. So I think that there's a lot of unmet economic potential in building the farm to grocery institutions. It was really interesting for us to see that grocery stores are already serving many of those institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So where we can substitute locally grown foods and then have that more of that those dollars stay in the community, I think this is a really good strategy. It's one that we're really trying to build. When we asked the grocers, what are your concerns? One of them was regulation. Some grocers think that we can't buy your sweet corn and then turn around and sell it to the hospital. So that's building that rural grocery toolkit, which we're going to be delivering out throughout the state, is one way for grocers to be comfortable that this, we don't just have to buy our food off the wholesale truck. We can buy it directly from farmers, assuming they follow the regulations, which we've really clearly been able to put together. But we do see a lot more economic potential. And using your grocery store as, if I can use the term, food hub for your community, I think there's a lot of opportunities. They have the produce coolers, the walk-in coolers. They have a lot of the infrastructure in back. The Minnesota regulations allow, for example, if you have a lot of seniors in your community, those squash can be cut in half and seeded, so it's easier for a senior to have access to squash. I mean, I think we've got a multitude of examples where we can build upon the existing pieces of infrastructure like rural grocery stores to serve our regional and local food systems, including institutions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Don't believe we have any other questions, and we'll continue on unless Representative Anderson has a question. Yes?
Thanks again, Madam Chair. And again, to Ms. Drager, looked up here in some statute books, there are some regulations pertaining to selling milk at a loss or at 105% of their cost. So how does that play into the example you gave about somebody paying more wholesale than somebody selling retail.
Dr. Drager?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's why I said there is a gap in the research. That was exactly the question posed to me by the grocer, and I don't have an answer for that. And if that rule is still on the books, then I think it bears some question as to whether the pricing for some of these small town stores is creating an equal playing field, whether that's the wholesale pricing or the retail pricing. I think it needs to be investigated, and I should say researched. So, but I think those are real issues, and I've had grocers from many parts of the state, southeastern Minnesota and other parts, express, I've had multiple grocers express that concern to me.
Representative Anderson.
Well, according to this book, it's still on the book, so we should maybe look into that.
I think you've raised an issue. It's good to have dairy farmers on the committee who are paying attention to that. So thank you for that, Representative Anderson. And over here, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Rausch, I believe you talked about the food deserts, especially around some of the Indian reservations in the state.
Yes.
So I know in the Renshaw Carlton area, there's some co-ops that are going on, especially around the produce. Do you know if there's been efforts to reach out to Fond du Lac to maybe help with that situation? And I'm just thinking if we could expand that, because I know there's other groups that are looking further down the road for that type of things in other areas for some of these produce co-ops to help out with that food desert issue with the reservations.
I don't off the top of my head, but the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis has a center for Indian country, and I certainly can raise that issue to our staff. I think that's something that they would be very interested in.
Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'd appreciate that, and maybe if you could get back to us on what the results on that, because I think with some of the people that are on extension, Dr. Abbas for one and others are taking a look at those type projects that might help out in those areas. So I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you again to the panelists for coming forward and definitely giving us lots of information and perhaps some potential for other legislation that may be coming forward. So thank you for that. We're going to move on to Ashley Bress, and talk about the Good Food Access Report that the Department of Ag is required to do, and Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and while the test fire is moving forward, I just want to say that, you know, when this proposal was initially brought forward, we had a lot of support within our committee. We did have some challenges. There's some heavy lifting in order to get it across the finish line to get the program established. But I want to thank all the people and the various groups that have worked on this. Obviously, it's extremely important. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing this forward again and putting some more money, some real dollars behind this. You know, I serve on Health and Human Services Finance as well. And we recently learned that the state of Minnesota spends a vast majority of our monies, the taxpayer dollars, on treatment-type programs and very little on prevention. And in the words of Mr. Mua, when he said that it's not only the right thing to do, but it's the smart thing to do, that was pretty powerful. And again, I simply want to thank you and the others. Madam Chair, I do need to excuse myself. There's an event taking place honoring my former boss, the late Bob Christensen, today. And I want to make sure that I go to that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you, Representative Hamilton. And, you know, this is when the Ag Committee works well together. We are certainly a bipartisan effort, and bringing forward good legislation is always important to us. And my sympathies again to you, Representative Hamilton. I know that that's an important event for you to attend, so thank you. And Ms. Bress, now you are before us, and we welcome you to the committee. And so if you just want to give us your name and then your presentation, please.
Right. Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present. My name is Ashley Bress. I supervise grant making over at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. In that capacity, I also oversee implementation of the Good Food Access Program. In your packets in front of you, you should have copies of my PowerPoint presentation as well as a copy of the legislative report. The Good Food Access Program was established in 2016 by statute to increase the availability of and access to affordable and nutritious foods in food deserts and for underserved communities in low-income and moderate-income areas. This can occur through financial support and technical assistance to open, renovate, or expand the operations of grocery stores and small food retailers such as corner stores and farmers markets. Statute also created a 25-member advisory committee to help us guide implementation of the program. You've already heard from a couple members of the advisory committee this morning, and you'll hear from another one later today. The committee is comprised of leaders of state agencies and extension and from organizations representing farmers, public health, grocers, economic development, philanthropic organizations, and more. You'll have an opportunity to hear from a couple of them, as I've said. When the program was first established in 2016, it also created the Good Food Access account in the Agricultural Fund. What's special about this account is that monies do not expire and they earn interest for the program. For the first year of the program, so fiscal year 2017, $250,000 was appropriated into the Good Food Access account. In consultation with the advisory committee, we set aside 10% or $25,000 to support the administrative costs of getting the program going. Of the $250,000, we used $150,000 in that first year for grant making. And we're currently working on spending the last $75,000 now. In fiscal years 2018, the budget writer for the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Program, or AGRI, allows for up to $250,000 to be used for the Good Food Access program. In fiscal year 18, we used $233,000 of the amount, and we're looking forward to doing the same in 2019. In consultation with the advisory committee, we have created two grant programs. The first and the more established of those two is our equipment and physical improvement program. These grants are designed to help grocery stores and other small food retailers by purchasing the equipment that they need to sell affordable and new nutritious foods and remain a viable community resource. Retailers can request up to $50,000 without a mandatory match requirement. Most commonly, stores are purchasing things like produce coolers and freezers and display cases. Demand for this program has been extremely strong. In the first year of the program, fiscal year 2017, we received 60 applications from across the state. We were able to, those applications were requesting approximately $1.4 million. Of those 60, we awarded 8 for a total of $150,000 that we invested that year. In 2018, demand remained strong. We received 41 applications, requesting just over $800,000. The odds were a bit better for applicants that year, and we were able to award 14 applications for $233,750. Our 2019 request for proposals closed about 2.5 weeks ago now. We received 34 applications requesting $1.1 million. We're looking forward to investing approximately $150,000, so hopefully we'll be able to meet about 15% of the request. Those applications are currently under review by a committee comprised of internal and external community-based reviewers. The second grant opportunity that we've created is for technical assistance providers. So this is most commonly going to mean or organizations such as local public health, economic development, or community development financial institutions. These projects are really intended to allow these technical assistance providers to go out into the community and work one-on-one or in small groups settings with retailers by meeting them where they're at and working with them on their needs. So this might mean things like business planning, cash flow projections, sales projections, or the marketing of fruits and vegetables. We've set aside $150,000 for this purpose. Applicants have until March 14th to submit their proposals. The program will cover 75% of the costs, with the applicant responsible for the remainder. I thank you for the opportunity to present the report, and I'll be happy to take questions whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Ms. Bruss. I appreciate that. It is in the packet, and people can, we do have the information, so we can review it. And thank you for the presentation today. We will move on to the bill that we have before us. Thank you. And if I can just have the presenters come down, because I'm going to just be able to share with you what this bill is. So it's House File 436, and I just move that we move House File 436 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill. And just it's the bill is in your packet. You can see that it's to provide $2.5 million each fiscal year for the Good Food Access Program, and it would be separate from AGRI, which is how it's been used, funded in the past, and it's for a little bit larger amount. But we have a number of presenters, and everybody has about 2 minutes to be able to present, and so if we can hold questions till the end, but we encourage questions if you do have some. So I appreciate that. And Ms. Schmidt, I think I'll turn it over to you to begin the testimony.
Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lorna Schmidt. I'm the Government Relations Director with the American Heart Association. I appreciate the attention being given to this issue today, and for Chair Poppy, as well as Representative Hamilton and others on this committee for their sponsorship of this bill. The American Heart Association is one of dozens of organizations, including those from healthcare, nonprofit, agriculture, grocers, economic development, that support the Good Food Access Fund, which, as you've now heard, was designed to support small food retailers who are working to address Minnesota's food access challenges. House File 436 would invest $2.5 million per year in the Good Food Access Fund. This figure is based on what we know about the demand that we've seen for the equipment grants from the first three rounds of funding, data that you've heard as well on rural grocers, and conversations that we've had with partners about what it would take to get a revolving loan up and running. That loan aspect is something that's currently allowed for within statute but hasn't yet been realized. And we are looking at that as an important component of this program because of what it means for sustainability and because of the potential to leverage private and philanthropic dollars through a match. And you'll hear some of our testifiers speak more to that today. Good Food Access has had a positive impact on more than 20 communities to date. But as you've heard, these challenges still exist. And again, we've yet to realize the full potential of this program. A reinvestment is needed this year if this work is to continue. So with me today, we've brought four individuals who have very unique perspectives on how the Good Food Access Fund has benefited their work in their communities, as well as the need that they see for continuing to support small food retailers throughout the state. So with that, I will turn it over to them. Thank you.
Thank you. So welcome to the committee. I'll just ask that you say your name and then provide the testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Corey Christensen, co-owner of Casey's Country Market in Badger since late 2011. And very recently another grocery store in Greenbush, Minnesota. Thank you for this opportunity to share my perspective on how the Good Food Access Fund is working and its benefits to our community. My family is from the Badger-Roseau area with over 125 years of history there. After several years abroad, I returned home to buy a grocery store, the same one my parents owned for 17 years until the year 2000. Badger, like many small towns with its exceptional schools, an ideal place to raise a family. Casey's Country Market is central to my family. We're all involved. My daughter sitting right over here is also central to our community. With our market, people don't have to travel for miles to buy healthy food staples. And this is very important to our senior residents, especially in the winter, especially this last week. But it's not easy to operate a grocery store in a small community. Margins are an ongoing challenge as our equipment upgrades. Thanks to the Good Food Access Fund, we were able to add a produce deli cooler, resulting in 35 extra feet to our produce section, bringing us to about 130 feet. The cooler means that we can offer more locally grown produce and collaborate more with local growers. This department is our fastest growing section, and we see there's a lot more potential there. Small grocers are known for being innovative and adaptive. With the right tools, we stay cooperative or competitive. If a store with old equipment closes, it's very difficult for that store to reopen. Thanks to the Good Food Access Fund in part, I'd like to think we've saved two communities from this fate. Both the communities were at risk of closing in the next months. These communities are home to workers at Polaris, Marvin Windows, DigiKey, Arctic Cat, Central Boiler, and large grain, beef, and turkey farms, just to name a few. Rural grocery stores contribute to small town economies and create jobs, making them vital to a community's survival and success. If you've grown up in one or spent time in a rock bowl painting, you know what I mean. A grocery store can bring people in who then frequent other local businesses. And it's one of the things people look for when choosing where to live, right up there with good schools. And I'm wondering if you've heard about our nationally owned robotics programs and our high school band just recently stealing the show at the recent Minnesota School Board Conference. Our store makes contributions to these and others, putting money back into our community. The Good Food Access Fund has helped us accomplish our goal for Badger, but as you already heard, there are still many other grocers trying to meet theirs. In fact, a businessman from Halstead just contacted me on Friday to discuss similar needs for resources. That store, as far as I know, recently closed. Even with the opening of our new grocery store in Greenbush, we are facing a number of unexpected and expensive challenges. So many that we submitted another grant for the RFP that just closed. Continuing to fund this effort would mean brighter futures for more rural grocers who are looking for ways to stay competitive. And when they succeed, it's the communities, the residents, and local agriculture producers who benefit through healthy foods, a stable business community, and new markets. Thank you. And I'm willing to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen, and thank you for traveling the long distance to be here today. Appreciate that. All right. Next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Ben DeVore. I'm a beginning farmer in the Stillwater Lake Elmo area. I help manage a 2.5-acre community farm. We have a CSA, a market stand, and community farmer plots. My passion for farming stems from the belief that growing healthy, sustainably managed produce and distributing it at affordable prices not only gets fresh vegetables to those that might not otherwise have access to it, but also builds community around the activity of growing food. At Cimarron Farm, our mission centers around providing access to local, healthy produce to the immediate community we're located in, a community where the gas station is the most accessible food retailer in the region. In my community, there's a high demand for fresh produce, and it can be a struggle to keep up with that demand. One of the biggest barriers we face as farmers is knowing how we will store and transport our produce. I am here today because the Good Food Access Fund has had a huge impact in removing that challenge for us. We were awarded a Good Food Access grant in 2018, and with it we were able to purchase a mobile cooler. Though it may sound minor, this cooler has given us as growers greater security in planting and harvesting because we now know we have a secure storage to keep our vegetables fresh longer. It also greatly benefits us as retailers as we have a secure and efficient means of transporting produce to the market. As a result, we've been able to harvest more produce, expand our market, and increase sales. Last year, for example, we were able to support 40 new EBT customers. I'm excited to begin my second year of farming this spring because I've seen a large and direct impact on an operation like Cimarron Farm can have on the local food movement as well as the health of my community. The grant we received from the Good Food Access Grant had an important role in that, and we are grateful for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeVore. Next. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. Thank you for your time today. My name is Lori Thorpe. I am the Executive Director of the Food Group, and we are a Good Food Access Grant recipient as well. Our mission statement is fighting hunger, nourishing our community. We are a food access organization that uses nutritious food to strengthen community. We support over 160 food shelves and meal programs across 30 counties in the state of Minnesota. We also have a program called Fair for All that is what received the funding from the Good Food Access Program. Fair for All is a traveling grocery sales program that purchases nutritional food at wholesale. We assemble those foods into packages of fresh produce and frozen meats, and we sell those packs at up to 30 to 40% off retail prices at 38 sites across Minnesota. Fair for All primarily serves that group of individuals that don't qualify for SNAP benefits or other safety net programs, but are really struggling to make ends meet. We have always focused this program on foods that tend to be more expensive, like fresh produce and quality meats, allowing our customers to stretch their food budgets. We source opportunity buys in the marketplace and in the secondary market so that we can keep our prices low and keep that food from going to waste. We currently have monthly sales at 38 locations, which include several in the metro and other cities such as Mankato, Buffalo, Red Wing, and St. Joseph. The program has grown over 33% in the last 5 years with annual sales just under $2 million. And we have a waiting list of over 40 locations who are asking us to bring Fair for All to their community, ranging from Hibbing to Alexandria to Litchfield to Owatonna. The further out into rural Minnesota we have gone, the more success we have had, as there are simply not as many choices for customers in those areas. Going forward, our expansion plans are focused on the rural part of our state. We would not have been able to expand Fair for All without the help of the Good Food Access Fund. Our freezer capacity was maxed out because we're serving more and more food shelves and trying to expand Fair for All. We needed to install a second 3,200 square foot freezer in our warehouse in New Hope. This project costs over $400,000 and is being funded by a combination of piecing together private foundation grants, a large grant from the USDA, individual donors, and lastly, thank you, from the Good Food Access Program. This funding has allowed us to put the finishing touches on our freezer by purchasing all of the racking. We just fired up the compressors over the weekend. Now the racking's going to go in. We're putting the bumpers on the outside, and then we're installing the temperature alarm thanks to the Good Food Access Program. We've not been able to add any new Fair for All sites because we've been maxed out in our freezer space in the last year. This funding allows us to implement our expansion plans in rural Minnesota in 2019. As the Fair for All program continues to grow, our capital needs will continue to arise. And capital grants are not easy to find, and they're not easy to get. So it is very reassuring to know a fund like the Good Food Access Program exists to continue to support our ability to increase access to affordable and nutritious foods across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tharp. And we have one other presenter. Welcome to the committee and begin your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Lars Kino. I'm a program officer with Local Initiative Support Corporation based in Duluth. I grew up in a family-owned grocery store business, and so I'm passionate about this sector and passionate about food access. I'm here to talk to you about a neighborhood in Duluth, Lincoln Park. Lincoln Park is a commercial corridor redevelopment rising star. It's gained national attention for what's happened there. In 3 years of work, we have 35 new or expanded businesses, 250-plus jobs, and so lots of good things happening in Lincoln Park. Yet, at the same time, it's a designated food desert. People don't have access to food. In a recent St. Louis County Health Survey, it revealed that people that lived in Lincoln Park die 11 years younger than their adjacent neighborhoods. And so there's a significant health impact. The neighborhood demographics don't appeal to chain grocers. Our community initiative, Fair Food Access, driven by the food desert, funded by Blue Cross Blue Shield. In 5 years of work, we had five goals, and the goal that we were not able to achieve was attracting a grocery store. One of the challenges is attracting capital or getting capital for people who are trying to either improve, expand, or build a grocery store. Independent small grocers tend to be undercapitalized. It's the nature of the sector. It requires intense capitalization both from equipment and from an inventory perspective. The lack of capital creates a gap in financing, and so we need some help. We need to help fulfill that gap, and what that gap will ultimately do is help us leverage other sources of capital, both private and philanthropic. Investing in the Good Food Access Program will improve the economic health of our communities, and it will also improve the economic health of our community members. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Kuhnel. Are there any questions for these presenters? All right, testifiers. Is there anyone in the audience who wanted to testify on, in support or in opposition to this bill? House File 436. All right, thank you for the testimony today. Thank you again for traveling the distance and being here. Appreciate that. So I'm going to renew the motion that House File 436 be laid over for possible inclusion in omnibus finance bill. And so the bill is laid over. And just a reminder, on Thursday we will have a meeting, and we have one more motion because we do have a quorum. So Representative Brand. And the minutes.
Yes, I renew my motion, Madam Chair, to approve the minutes from the last meeting.
Okay, so the motion to approve the minutes from the January 31st meeting. All those in favor, any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.